Greetings, good evening, good day, all of you. Welcome to the 15th episode of the Indian Interest Podcast. I hope you are all doing great. And I really appreciate those of you who are tuning in to watch this live despite a World Cup quarterfinal match going on. So thank you to all of you who have done that. Thank you so much. And before we begin, as always, let me take a look at who all is there on the live chat. Let me greet you all. I can see Nabanita Das, Sanath, Nisarg, Salad Mansur, Saswat, Lodh, Meme Studio, Suryansh, Kapil, Khushirani, Atharva, Pranav, Harsh Bhatt, Apurva, Hemant, Akshit, Kushal, Abhinav, Saikiran, Durga, Karthik, Ayush, Kamlesh, Rustin Cole, Pranav Sharma, Social Pathak, Dhiraj Yadav, Sarthak, Abhiman, Priyanshu, Monish, Atharva, Kapil, Pranav, Akshit, Priyanka, Ganesh, Giga Chad Putin, Stark, Om Bekerikar, Potul Potul, Mahabali Putin, Atharva, Matteo Perez, Typical Gamer, Jai, Partha Sarthi Banerjee, Vladimir Biden, Akshit, Clipper Flipper, Probal Barman, Martian, Darshan Shrimal, Ayush Singh, Kaustubh, Gummy Jain, Swapnil, Samya Ray, Lokik, and lots of other people. Thank you all for being on this live telecast, live show. So what shall we talk about? We're going to discuss a bunch of things, a lot of things. We're going to talk about the Ukraine situation, Mr. Zelensky's Times Person of the Year. There's the Saudi Arabia, the China-Saudi Arabia interaction that's happening right now. President Xi is in, has visited Saudi Arabia and so on and so forth. Lots of things happening. Pakistan, Afghanistan, that situation we have not spoken about for a while. But let me begin with something that I spoke about last week. And that it's about international relations, the principles of international relations. How does it all work, right? So that's something that many of us are kind of confused about. So last week I spoke. What I want to speak about first is which nations are India's friends, if such a thing does exist, friendship in international relations. Because last week I spoke about Israel, the India-Israel relations in the context of the Nadav Lapid fiasco, the Naor Gilon statements, the statements that he made and he did not make, the Israeli ambassador to India. Yeah, the fact that Naor Gilon, the ambassador of Israel, did not refute Nadav Lapid's claims that the Kashmir genocide is propaganda. He did not support India's rightful stand on Jammu and Kashmir, right? The fact that Israel recognizes the Holocaust but does not recognize the Kashmir genocide and so on and so forth. Yeah, I spoke about these things and many people got upset. Many people are saying that I'm trying to vitiate India-Israel relations. I'm not doing that. It's Nadav Lapid and Naor Gilon who did that, right? And some people think that I'm asking Indians to hate Israel and the Jewish people. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. I have said on the record multiple times how I admire Israel for many things, how I have a lot of respect for Israel, and how I would like India-Israel relations to get even stronger. I have said this, yes? And yet people react emotionally to facts. Emotional reactions. Reactions based on emotions, not on facts. The truth is that Indians are a very emotional people. Yes? What's the definition of emotional people? I mean, everybody has emotions. I have emotions. I get angry at times. I get overjoyed, happy, and so on and so forth. Sad. Everybody has emotions. But some people make choices and decisions based on facts and evidence, whereas some people make choices and decisions based on emotions and moods. That's the definition of an emotional person. Everybody has emotions. But if you make your choices and decisions based on your emotions and your mood, then you're an emotional person. But if you make your facts, your choices and decisions rationally, based on facts and evidence and data, then you are a more balanced, more grounded person. And in geopolitics, in international relations, emotions have nothing to do with these things. So India, especially in India, and even I'm sure in other places as well, we have these incredibly naive views among Indians about international relations. There is, we see this very often, very, very, it's very widespread, this blind hero worship of certain nations. Now, we Indians, we belong to the civilization that produced luminaries such as the great Vishnugupta Chanakya. And yet we are so naive when it comes to understanding international relations. It's not the fault of you all, in case you are like this. It is not your fault. It is the fault of the education system that does not teach the precepts of Vishnugupta Chanakya. Instead of that, it teaches you the values and precepts of Mohandas Gandhi. And that's why you are all so badly misled. And that is what I want to talk about. We need to have a more realistic view of other nations. This doesn't apply only to Indians. This applies to everybody. No matter what nation you're from, if you're watching this, I'm going to speak about this from the perspective of India, but it applies to everyone. It's all about the principles of geopolitics. These apply everywhere in the world. Yeah, what are the principles of geopolitics? First of all, it's all about self-interest. Geopolitical relations are all on the basis of the self-interest of the nations, of each nation. And when there is a convergence of interest, then nations collaborate and cooperate in a variety of ways. Geopolitics is about temporary alliances. Nothing is permanent. Temporary alliances and temporary adversary relations, yeah? And the alliances and self-interest are all based on economics and trade and defense and national threat perceptions, national goals, national boundaries, national interests, and the convergence of interests, right? And this is something that most Indians simply don't understand. They're all emotional about certain nations. They have this this incredible one-sided relationship with certain nations, this one-sided love relationship that I love so-and-so nation. We are brothers. We are a family. Sometimes disputes happen between members of a family, but the bigger truth is that we love each other. This is one-sided love. There is no love in geopolitics, right? So let me expand upon this from a more 360-degree perspective. We spoke about Israel. I'm going to speak about Israel again, but I'm also going to speak about some other nations. And try to show you, demonstrate certain facts. I'm not giving you my opinion. I'm going to put forth some facts for your perusal. So let's put some facts on the screen, shall we? Let's begin with Israel, since we were discussing Israel last week. So we know that Israel is a nation that lots of Indians have this incredible love for. Great, okay. So let's go to the put that back on the screen. One second, give me a second. Okay, we were discussing Israel, so let's start with Israel. Here we are. This is Israel. Now, this is the Israeli official Israeli government website of their Ministry of Foreign Affairs. As you can see, if you see the link in the over here, embassies.gov.il, embassies.gov.il. This is the officially Israeli website of their Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Now, let's go to this page about the various embassies of Israel in its region, right? Regional embassies of Israel. There's this map that they've put out over here. Let's zoom into the map, shall we? Shall we look into the zoom in to the map that the Israelis have put on their official website? And there's a whole number of nations over here, colored in various, mostly shades of green. And let's take a look at India in the official map that the Israelis have put forth. This is their official worldview. Let's zoom in and see what India looks like in their map. So if you look here, India is only shown partially, but it shows enough for us to understand their perspective. Look at the map of India. It's a truncated map of India. Pakistan-occupied Jammu and Kashmir is shown as part of Pakistan. And not only that, Aksai Chin, which rightfully belongs to India, is shown as part of China. They have not showed any dashed lines which indicate territorial disputes. They are simply stating that Pakistan-occupied Jammu and Kashmir officially belongs to China. There's no dashed line here. So they in their perspective, it belongs to Pakistan. And again, there is no dashed line for Aksai Chin. For them, for Israel, Aksai Chin officially belongs to China. So understand that Israel supports Pakistan's claims on Kashmir, on Jammu and Kashmir, whatever part they have occupied currently. So the Israelis support Pakistan's perspectives and claims on Kashmir and China's perspectives and claims on Aksai Chin. And who knows what they believe about Arunachal Pradesh, right? So that's one thing. Now let's take a look at another document. This is again an official government document of Israel, www.gov.il. It's a feasibility study about something or the other at the Haifa and Ashdod ports. So this is an official government document. Now let's go to page number 42. Here's a map of more or less the world. Let's zoom in. My dear friends, let's zoom in. So thankfully, they have placed Arunachal Pradesh within India. But once again, they are showing POJK as part of Pakistan. And there seems to be a dashed line with Aksai Chin. So over here, it's like only... so over here, the situation is different. Once again, they don't recognize India's maps. The External Affairs Minister of India, Dr. Jaishankar, had said this, that our Quad... the members of the Quad, they refuse to accept India's perception of its map, India's map, right? They don't even recognize India's map. So here we see the same thing with respect to Israel as well. So there you go. So please understand. So what I am showing you is not my opinion. I am not expressing an opinion here. I am showing you actual facts. You can go to the website. The link is over here. You can see the links over here. These are official Israeli government documents. Check it out for yourself and see for yourself what Israel believes, how Israel sees India's geography, right? Now, let's talk about the relationship between Israel and China. Indians believe that Israel has this exclusive love relationship with India. So this is a document, this is a news report from Nikkei Asian Review from May 2014. This news report, this article has been conveniently deleted from the internet, but I was able to search for it. I was able to find it on the web archive. So it says that Israel pivots to China and India as US influence wanes. Yeah, this was from 2014. So first China, then India. So Israel is working hard to build stronger security and economic ties with China and India, looking to broaden its options as the US, its closest ally, starts to play the smaller role on the world stage. So you see, Israel is looking out for its own national interest. If the US, see, in 2014 itself, it was visible, it was apparent that the US influence in the world is declining, it's waning. Yeah, so Israel was looking to broaden its options and it was working hard to build stronger security and economic ties with China and also with India. So China figures very strongly in this, but the Americans made Israel understand that strong security and military ties with China are not good. It is not in Israel's best interest. The Americans were able to convince Israel of this through a variety of means. Okay. Let's talk about Israel's international relations with China. This is the Jewish Virtual Library.org. So Israel and China first established diplomatic relations in January 1992, and so on and so forth. Lots of things have happened. China is now Israel's third largest trading partner globally. Lots of good stuff is happening. There's a lot of academic cooperation. There is tourism and culture, and there is military cooperation, my dear friends, military cooperation. China and Israel have developed close strategic military links with each other. Yeah, and it goes on to... elucidate what sort of military links they have. Yeah, so let's go into certain interesting things that, my dear friends, you don't know about. Yes, have you heard about the Chengdu J-10 fighter plane, the Chinese fighter plane, Chengdu J-10? They are selling this fighter plane to our dear friends, our cousins, our blood brothers and sisters, the Pakistanis. Pakistan has acquired, I believe, I don't know how many, 36 of these. How many? 36, 12 delivered, 24 on order. I don't know what date this was for, but yeah, the Pakistanis have apparently bought at least 36 of these aircraft. This is a very good aircraft, the Chengdu J-10. Do you know the history of this wonderful aircraft? Let's see what it looks like. This is what it looks like, right? Now, let me show you a different aircraft, this one. Can you see any similarity between these two aircraft? The truth is that this aircraft that you see here is a derivative of the other aircraft, of this aircraft. It's a derivative of this aircraft. So which is this aircraft from which the Chinese plane is derived? This is the Israeli IAI Lavi plane. So this aircraft, which the Israelis started developing in the 1980s, was based on the American F-16 fighter plane. And this aircraft that the Israelis developed was better than the F-16 fighter plane. But somehow the Israelis, they eventually decided to scrap this development program. If they had not scrapped it, the Israelis would have been operating one of the world's most advanced fighter. Yeah, but the Israeli cabinet, the government, cancelled this program by a 12-11 vote in the 1980s. Obviously, the Americans would have arm-twisted them into doing this, and then they made Israel buy more F-16 fighter planes. And now the Israelis are buying the American F-35 fighter plane, which is not so great. Anyhow, so then what happened is that, see, website tells you that Israel and China established diplomatic relations in 1992. And even before that, the Israelis apparently transferred the technology or whatever, the design of this aircraft to the Chinese. Yes, even here, it you will see it said, let's talk about military cooperation. Israel aircraft industry, see, Israel sold technology to upgrade Chinese tanks and planes in the 1980s. IAI Lavi, this aircraft which you're talking about, and also UAV technology may also have been sold to China. And this happened even before the Israelis and the Chinese established diplomatic relations. So what I'm trying to tell you is that we have to understand that every nation has its own interests. They will do what is best for them. China is a much larger market than India. And the Israelis would love nothing more than to have lots of great cooperation and trade with the Chinese, even military cooperation, strategic cooperation. Like you see, they sold the design of this aircraft to the Chinese. They did that. Yes, and the Chinese are now selling it to Pakistan. So indirectly, Israel ended up helping Pakistan. See, Pakistan purchases Chinese jets based on scrapped Israeli Lavi fighter. The Israelis were forced by the Americans to scrap this fighter plane. Otherwise, they would have had a much better fighter plane than anything the Americans have. So that's something that you should know about. Yes. Now, this is a website called Haaretz. It's an Israeli website. I think it dates back to the early 20th century, the publication, and now it's online. Yes, in the 21st century. So this website, look at the headline, 72 CE or AD. Thomas the Apostle is murdered in India. According to common Christian tradition, doubting Thomas, a practicing Jew, was killed by jealous Hindu priests of Kali or a peacock hunter or whatever. Hindus killed him. This is fake news. This is a lie. It's a fabrication. It's a distortion of history. There is zero evidence, zero actual hard evidence that this individual, Thomas the Apostle, ever came to India. It's all fabricated. There is no actual hard historical evidence, not a shred of it, that Thomas the Apostle came to India. And yet this Israeli website is propagating this lie, this myth. Yeah, Haaretz is one of the most important and, you know, one of the most prominent Israeli publications. So there you see once again what Israel is doing. See, this is on Swaraj, the Haaretz paradox. Why would an Israeli newspaper propagate the myth that Thomas came to India and was killed by Hindu priests? That's what Arvindan Nilakandan is writing about. Clearly, he's very hurt. He's a great scholar, Arvindan Nilakandan. I have the greatest respect for him. So he's put out all the data, all the actual facts, that this is a complete lie and complete fabrication. Any historian would understand this. And it concludes, the article concludes by saying that it is sadder that such an act is indulged in by a magazine that comes from a people who have painfully experienced and documented their own suffering and hence know very well what happens when such stereotypes and legends of hatred are perpetuated. Very hurt. And so that's what Israel is doing, yes? Right? And this again, once again, is a book. It's called On the Myth of St. Thomas and the Mylapur Shiva Temple by Ishwar Sharan. This is available online for free. You can pause this video in the future and take a look at the link which is visible over here. I'm not going to put links in the description. You can look it up, Google it, or see the link over here. Right? Now let's talk about Israel. Israel considers itself to be a Western nation, right? Israel is a Western nation. Even though it is physically in Asia, it considers itself to be a Western nation, despite having a majority non-white population. The Mizrahi Jews are the Oriental Jews or the original Jews. The true Jews are the Mizrahi Jews. These are brown-skinned Jews. They are not white Jews. That's what the Mizrahi Jews look like. Israel's Mizrahi activists are fighting the racist nation-state law, and so on and so forth. So the Mizrahi people are not white people. These are brown-skinned Asiatic Jews. These are the original Jews. The original Jews were not white people. The Ashkenazim are the white Jews, those who spent a lot of time in Europe, centuries, you know. And it's not their fault they had to do that. That's a whole different story. We are not going into that history. But the Mizrahi Jews that I'm talking about are approximately 45% of Israel's population. 45% are Mizrahi Jews, brown-skinned, non-white Jews. 44.9, almost 45%. Then Israel is also home to the Arab citizens of Israel, who are, what is the percentage? 20.95% of Israel population. So 20% Arabs and 45% Mizrahi Jews. That's 65% of Israel's population are non-whites. Arabs are non-whites, by the way. Excuse me. If someone considers Arabs to be whites, white people, then you need to reconsider the basis of your assumption. So 65% of Israel's population is not white. It is of Asian origin. And yet Israel considers itself to be a Western nation. So understand, I have nothing against that. Let them consider whatever they want to. Let them see themselves as whatever they want to do, right? It's their choice. It is their prerogative how they see themselves. So Israel sees itself as a Western nation. We have to accept this as a fact. It is a fact. Now, you may have seen one of my previous episodes of the Indian Interest about the Jayashankar Doctrine. What is it? There are a number of points in the Jayashankar Doctrine that I have elucidated. One of the points is that the West imposed 2 centuries of national humiliation on India. More than $45 trillion worth of Indian treasure was looted out of India. There was incredible genocide. And then you have the sanctimony in lecturing human rights, of democracy, all that nonsense that the West is still heaping upon India. Yeah. So firstly, 2 centuries plus of national humiliation imposed by the West upon India. And Dr. Jayashankar is very clear about what is the West. It is the US and its satellite states, its vassals. It's the Anglosphere, the Five Eyes nations, the US, Canada, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand. That's the Anglosphere. Plus the EU, which is dominated by the US, plus NATO, which is dominated by the US, and also Japan, South Korea, and Israel. So the West is not a geographic designation, but a political concept, which emerged from the end of the Second World War and out of the Cold War. That is the West. The West is led and represented by the US. The West is essentially the US empire, right? That's what I spoke about. Israel is very much a part of that, right? So understand that Israel is a Western nation. It doesn't see itself as an Eastern nation, as an Asian nation. It is very much Western in character, right? So that's something we have to understand about Israel. Now, I am showing you facts and data and evidence, okay? I am not asking anybody to hate Israel. I'm asking you to be realistic. I'm asking you to look at the world from a realistic perspective. Israel doesn't love India. Israel doesn't hate India. India and Israel have excellent relations because of our convergence of national interests and strategic interests. That is the only legitimate and valid basis on which international relations are done, right? That's the only basis of international relations, convergence of interests. So that's why India and Israel have a strong relationship, and I wish and I would like to see this relationship become even more robust. Plus, but please disabuse yourselves of this notion, of this delusional belief that Israel loves India. India and Israel have nothing cultural in common. India and Israel are very, very different cultures. The cultures are poles apart. Israel sees itself as a Western nation. They don't even think the average Israeli person, he or she most likely doesn't even think of India. And if they do think of India, they are at best, most of them are at best, indifferent about India. They don't care. They don't think. And some of them, of course, we know, have significantly negative views about India. Not all. Some of them. Most of them are indifferent. These are facts. I don't care what your favorite Israeli YouTuber is telling you. I don't care. I don't know what they are saying. But I get the feeling these Israel, some of these YouTubers, etc., they try to put forth the fiction that Israel loves India. No, that is not true. So once again, I have shown you a whole bunch of facts that you can check for yourselves. I am showing you facts. Please form your understanding of international relations and the India-Israel relationship based on facts, not on emotions or feelings or fiction. All right? So once again, I am not asking you to hate Israel or dislike Israel. I want India and Israel to have a robust relationship that keeps growing stronger because our national interests converge to a significant interest. There is a lot for Israel to gain by having a strong relationship with India. India is a gigantic market. It's rising. It's growing. Israel will be able to enrich itself significantly if it does a lot of trade with India. And India, on the other hand, can acquire things that it needs from Israel, goods that it needs, and we can collaborate in a variety of ways in the military domain, in the strategic domain, and so on. So this is a very... It's a relationship with a great amount of potential. But international relations and geopolitics are not done on the basis of people-to-people connections. It's done on the basis of nation-to-nation connections, right? So understand this. So that is about Israel, right? So I hope that and one more thing I would like to put on the screen. Yeah, we spoke about the Arab citizens of Israel. Here's another interesting thing for you to think about. So this is an article, as you can see, from October 2010. That's like almost 12 years ago. China says that Pakistan is our Israel. The world's most populous country is showing more international assertiveness, which bothers the US. So the Chinese claim that Pakistan is our Israel. When a US delegate once confronted a Chinese diplomat in more than 10 years ago about Beijing's uncompromising support for Pakistan, the Chinese reportedly responded with a heavily loaded sarcastic remark, "Pakistan is our Israel." What does it mean? So this is from a time when the Americans were disengaging from Pakistan. They had given up on Pakistan. They no longer care about Pakistan. And the Chinese had stepped in to fill in the power vacuum, and they had become Pakistan's new big daddy. Right? And then they told the Americans that Pakistan is our Israel. What do they mean by that? It means that we are using Pakistan against India and in favor of our geopolitical interests, the same way the Americans have used Israel or are using Israel. What they mean to say is that the Americans in the West essentially uses Israel as a means to achieve certain geopolitical, geostrategic ends in the Middle East. If you know anything about the past 100 years of history, the so-called Middle East has been in a perpetual state of crisis, one crisis after another, since 1947, 1948, when Israel was created by the West. Before that, the nation state of Israel did not exist. The Jewish people have existed for 3,000 years. 2,000 years ago, that region was indeed the homeland of the Jews. And then they were evicted from that region by a whole number of by various empires. The Assyrians, the Romans, and so on and so forth, the Ottomans, the Arabs, and so on and so forth. So the Israelis the Jews stopped having a presence in that region, a significant presence. They stopped ruling, they ceased to rule the region. And this region, which is now called Israel, was recreated as a nation, it was created as a nation state in 1947, 1948 by the West. And ever since then, the Middle East has been in crisis. So the Chinese are implying that the Americans have used Israel as a means of creating these tensions, as one of the means of creating tensions in the Middle East region. It is their strategic asset in the Middle East to keep all the other nations off balance. Yeah. And now the Chinese are saying we are going to use Pakistan in the same way. So this is before the Americans have re-entered Pakistan. Now we know that the whole relationship has changed. Imran Khan has been evicted from the post of prime minister. He was selected. Now he has been deselected, and somebody else, Nawaz Sharif's younger brother, has been put in place as the new puppet prime minister. And now the Americans are firmly back in the saddle in Pakistan. And the Chinese are essentially out for all intents and purposes. So the Chinese intended to use Pakistan the same way the Americans use Israel. So understand the relationship between India, between America and in Israel as well. This is how international relations work. So, that is about Israel. Now, we should not confine our discussion only to Israel. We have to look at... See, otherwise, you would say that I'm solely targeting Israel or I have some agenda or something. It is not the case. So let's talk about certain other nations, shall we? Let us talk about Russia. Let's talk about Russia. Russia, lots of Indians have this incredible deep-seated love for Russia as well. Isn't it true? So let's take a look at Russia. Let's examine the case of Russia. Russia is, it's a rising power once again. Yeah. Now, let me put that on the screen one more time. All right, let's talk about Russia. Here it is. So, we have to understand what sort of history India and Russia have. So, Russia hasn't always... Russia has been one of India's greatest supporters. We can never forget what they did for India in 1971. Yes? They negated the effect of the American aircraft carrier strike group in the British aircraft carrier in the Bay of Bengal by sending their nuclear submarines. And essentially, they helped India. They prevented the Americans and the West from bullying India. And that's how India was able to achieve its objectives, which were achieved in 1971. Yes. So the Russians have helped India. They've helped India in a number of ways, in trade, in defense. They were India's primary supplier of weapons and arms and all that, and some technology transfer as well, and so on and so forth. So Russia has been good for India. But overall, if you look at the big relationship, we have to understand that Russia did everything for its own. When I talk about Russia, I mean the USSR. At that time, it was the USSR. Today's Russia is the political successor of the USSR. It's essentially the same entity repackaged as the nation-state of Russia. So it was called the USSR, and it was larger at the time. You can look at the history. It's not very important. What I'm saying is that whatever the USSR did then and whatever Russia is doing now is from its for its own national interest, for its own self-interest. We know, if you go back to the 1960s, we have the Lal Bahadur Shastri cover-up. Prime Minister Shastri died in Tashkent, which was then part of the USSR. His death was a big mystery. It was a very mysterious death. It has never been explained properly. And it was most likely a cover-up. Yes? And it happened in the USSR. And they have never come clean about what really happened. They would have all the documents. They would have all the data. We have discussed this on this channel with Anuj Dhar, who is one of the major experts in this field about this topic and so on. So the Russians covered up what happened there. This was essentially, in a way, a regime change in India. The untimely and very mysterious and very suspicious death of PM Shastri, Prime Minister Shastri, in a foreign nation, and then a new dispensation comes to power in India, and everything changes after that. Do you know, as long as Prime Minister Shastri was ruling India, there was no separatism in India, within India. The whatever soft separatism exists in various parts of India wasn't there. It did not exist at all. For instance, in the South, you have the so-called Dravidian separatism, soft separatism. Yeah, they see themselves as non-Indian in a way, non-Hindu. We are a separate civilization, separate people, all that nonsense. That started after Prime Minister Shastri's death. So a whole new dispensation came to power in India, one that possibly the USSR saw as more pro-USSR than Mr. Shastri was. So in a variety of ways, it helped the USSR. The death of Prime Minister Shastri, yes. Then we obviously have the revelations of Vasily Mitrokhin and Yuri Bezmenov. You can look into that. I'm not going to give an exposition on that. But it confirms the fact that India had eventually became a USSR puppet state, a satellite state of the USSR. Yes, that's what happened. The USSR infiltrated India deeply to the highest levels in governance and so on. You can do your own research about this. So they infiltrated India for their own interests, not for the interests of India. So understand this, that everything is done for whatever a nation does, they do it for their own self-interest. There is no friendship or love. From a people-to-people perspective, there may be a great deal of warmth, possibly, perhaps, between the people of India and the people of Russia. Perhaps, possibly, maybe. All right? But that doesn't matter. In international relations, you're going to use every means at your disposal. Now, look at this. This is from 2015. If India and Russia had this special privileged relationship, how did this happen? Russia agrees to sell 4 Mi-35 attack helicopters to Pakistan. Yes, this was in 2015, when the Russians became open to selling arms and ammunition and having military cooperation, defense cooperation with Pakistan, India's sworn enemy. The number one objective of Pakistan as a nation is to destroy India. And the Russians got into this relationship with the Pakistanis. Yes, 2015, they agreed to sell these helicopters. 2018, they began the delivery of advanced assault helicopters to Pakistan. These are really good helicopters, okay? So if they sell any kind of arms or ammunition to Russia, to Pakistan, everyone knows that in whenever the Pakistanis use it, they will use it against India. And Russia under Vladimir Putin was perfectly fine doing this. Understand this. Yes. Now, this is from 2021. This is from 2021, barely a year ago. Russia is ready to supply military equipment to Pakistan and hold more military drills with Pakistan. According to Mr. Lavrov, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, who is currently also the foreign minister of Russia. He has met recently with Dr. Jaishankar and expressed the need and the desire of Russia to have stronger relations with India. And just a year ago, just barely over a year ago, they were ready to sell more military equipment to Pakistan and hold more military drills with the Pakistanis. Yes? Isn't that nice? Yes? Let's see here. So then the Russians and Pakistanis began a series of military exercises. From 2016 onwards, it was called the Druzhba, friendship exercises. The first iteration of this, the Russia-Pakistan military exercises, was in 2016. Yes, this is from 2020. November 5, Russia's forces arrive in Pakistan for a joint military drill. Yes, and this is from 2021. Russia-Pakistani Druzhba 21 drills begin in southern Russia. About 100 Russian and 100 Pakistani service members will take part in this thing. So 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, and 2021 as well, the Russians and Pakistanis held joint military drills for better integration of the two armed forces and better relationship between the two militaries. Isn't that wonderful? Yes, with India's sworn enemy. But surprisingly, or maybe not so, there has been no Russia-Pakistan military exercise in 2022. I wonder why that is the case. I wonder what changed. Yeah? I wonder what changed. Now, let's talk about the FGFA aircraft, in case you all don't know about it or in case it's gone off everyone's radar. So this was an aircraft, Sukhoi HAL Hindustan Aeronautics Limited, FGFA, fifth generation fighter aircraft. Yes, this was a fighter aircraft that India and Russia were supposed to co-develop jointly. And much of it would come from the Russians, from Sukhoi, and India would pay for the bulk of the development. Yes, and this was to be based on the Sukhoi Su-57 aircraft, which is currently now in limited operation in the Russian Air Force, right? So, this aircraft was supposed to be designed and built mainly by the Russians, and India would provide all the money, and then there would be a complete technology transfer to India. And then India would become the co-owner of the aircraft, and all the technology would be whatever aircraft India would build would be built in India, and India would have the entire technology. So this was, I don't know how many billion dollar worth. Let me see. Okay, 25 billion. Okay, the initial investment was about 5 to 6 billion, and India had paid several hundred million dollars already. And then the Russians, what happened is that they refused to transfer the full technology to India, and they did not incorporate all the design changes, the design improvements that India wanted over the Su-57. Yeah, the stealth aspect of the aircraft was woefully inadequate and all. So it's like the Russians deliberately wanted to drag their feet and get as much money as possible out of India, but they did not want to offer India the technology that India was paying for. So after several years, India was left with no choice but to cancel the development of this aircraft. But India had already paid several hundred million dollars to Russia, which have never come back to India. So this is not the act of a friend. This is a very recent event. When was it cancelled? Let's see when it was cancelled. In 2019. It's a very recent thing. In October 2019, India officially cancelled this the co-development of this aircraft. This is what the aircraft was supposed to look like. It is based on the Russian Sukhoi 57 aircraft. Yeah. So yeah, that's what happened. The $8.63 billion advanced fighter aircraft with Russia put on ice. This was communicated by NSA Ajit Doval to the Russians. So as you can see, they have been very selfish. I mean, why would they not be? They want what is in their best interest, money. If you can get someone's money without giving them what they are paying for, why not? It's great. Yeah. So that's what happened. That's the India-Russia relationship until very recently, until 2019. And do you know about this submarine, about the saga of this aircraft carrier? this is an article from an American publication. So you have to be aware that this is written by Americans, all right? And they have their own perspective and they have their own biases. So remember that. This is from a publication called The National Interest. India is building its own aircraft carriers now, and it's all Russia's fault. So what's the story? What is the story of the INS Vikramaditya? Yeah. So this was initially a Kiev class aircraft, Russian warship. It was called the Baku. Then the USSR broke up and Baku became the capital of a foreign country, Azerbaijan. So then it was renamed to Admiral Gorshkov. It was a heavy cruiser or something it was called, this aircraft, this fighter plane. It was a helicopter, this warship. It was a helicopter carrier. It was also a cruise missile warship and all that. It had cruise missiles and various other missiles. Then the Russians offered to sell it to India. They said, we will give it to you for free, but we will do the modifications that you need to make it a proper aircraft carrier. And that will cost about $974 million. So we are giving you this ship for free, but you need to pay for the $974 million refit of the warship and to transform it into a proper aircraft carrier. So India paid the money, and then that's where all the trouble starts. Yeah. So what does it say? So essentially what happened is that Russia started dragging its feet. It started inflating the costs. It said, no, now it will not. And for 2-3 years, there was absolutely, I think it was supposed to be delivered by 2007. By 2009, India realized that even though it's not only is it overdue, it's already behind schedule, but it is not even 50% done, the work on it. So for 2-3 years, the Russians did not do any work at all on this. Then they asked for more money. I think they asked for about $3 billion or something. And then eventually the India had to renegotiate the whole thing. The Russians said that if India doesn't pay up, then we will keep the aircraft carrier. So India had already paid nearly $1 billion. Then the Russians stopped to work, refused to work further on it. And they said that if India doesn't pay further, then we will keep it for ourselves. And we'll keep the money as well. Eventually, after a very long time, India was able to acquire the thing, the aircraft carrier. And now India has decided we will not get any more Russian technology, Russian aircraft carriers. We will build our own aircraft carriers and our own warships. Even now, some Indian warships are being built in Russia. So I wonder what the situation is over there. Now I'm sure they are cooperating. But yeah, a few years ago, it was like this. That's the kind of behavior the Russians were showing. They wanted India's money, but they did not want to give India what India needed in exchange for the money. And then they inflated the price. I think India paid close to $2.5 or $3 billion eventually for this aircraft carrier. And even then, there were some problems and all, which we will not go into. That's a whole different story. Yes. So Russia has, this has been the attitude of Russia until very recently. Until very recently. So please understand, there is no love between India and Russia. Yeah. There is no friendship. It is all strategic ties. And if you want to see further, I mean, how did the Russian media portray India? Would you like to see that? Yes. Love and friendship, you say? Let's take a look at this. This is RT.com. Yeah, RT. Double despair. Widowed Indian women forced to beg on this in the streets to atone for women's death. What atone for women's for husband's death? See, here's what it says. In India, old superstitions say that a husband dies because of his wife's sins. Really? Where does it say in India? Until the 19th century, Indian widows were burnt alive with the bodies of the dead husbands. They are generalizing it. Like every single Indian widow was burnt alive as soon as her husband died. Even today, they must endure a lifetime of atonement and so on. They end up begging in the streets. Arranged marriages are a great sin and child brides are still common in India. So girls can be widowed quite young. Can you see what sort of stereotyping they're doing? The same stereotyping the English-speaking West does. The Russians were indulging in this until, this is an article from 2017, right? Barely, less than 5 years ago. Let's see one more. This is Cry of a River. The trouble with India's toilets and drinking water. This is from 2017. According to WHO, which the Russians no longer believe in today, because it's a Western organization. At that time, they believed in the WHO. A third of the world's population lives without access to proper toilets, blah, blah, blah. India is one of many countries in which rural populations suffer acutely and so on and so forth. You know, human waste and blah, natural water. The same stereotypes, Hindu-phobic, Indo-phobic stereotypes that the West propagates, the Russians were also propagating. Here's one more. India should prosecute, this is from 2017 again, India should prosecute cow vigilantes for brutal attacks on Muslims and untouchables. Who says this? HRW. What is HRW? Human Rights Watch. Today, the Russians do not believe in anything that Human Rights Watch says because the HRW is a Western organization. In 2017, they were perfectly happy to parrot the lies that the HRW was spewing. Right? There you are. And here's one more. This is their Twitter account from 2017. The same nonsense they're spouting over there based on all false lies and all lies and fake news. Here's one more. Death in the slum. This is from 2020. This is even more recent. Death in the slum. India holds its breath as coronavirus spreads to tightly packed shanty town. They're the same stereotypes that you see in the West. The Russians were also propagating the same stereotypes. But something has changed recently now. Recently, in recent times, Russia has become a great friend of India's. So my dear friends, Indians, there is no friendship or love in geopolitics, in international relations. Will this suffice to convince you that neither Russia nor Israel nor anybody else loves India? There is no friendship. Please understand this. Please understand. And it doesn't matter whether you're Indian or you're French or German or from Tahiti or wherever. It applies to all of us. These are general principles. There is no friendship in geopolitics. There is no love in geopolitics, in international relations. All right. Now let's speak about some more countries. Let's speak about certain other countries that Indians believe are great friends of India's. Yes. One of the great countries that many Indians have a significant amount of love for is Japan. Japan and India essentially are the same culture. Much of Japan's culture has come from India. So I understand why this perception exists. But okay, let's talk about Japan, right? So, what is the relationship that Japan enjoys with Pakistan? Have you given any thought to this particular question? What sort of relationship does Japan enjoy with Pakistan? Or rather, what sort of relationship does Pakistan enjoy with Japan? Let us find out, shall we, together, my dear friends? Yeah. This is from 2022, August 11. Mm-hmm. This is rather recent. This is like day before yesterday, almost. This is an article from Pakistan Today. PM, which is the Pakistan PM, welcomes Japanese investment of $1 billion in Pakistan. A delegation of Japanese investors called on Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif on Thursday and discussed matters related to investment in Pakistan. Yes. So the Japanese are investing $1 billion in Pakistan. Right? Here's some more. Japan, this is from October 12, 2022. This is barely less than 2 months ago. This is 2 months ago. Today is December 12. This is from October 12, 2022. It's 2 months ago. Japan vows to enhance investment in Pakistan, particularly in the energy sector. This is some more. Now let's talk about France. Indians also believe that France is one of India's greatest friends. So this is from September 1994. It is true that when India tested nuclear weapons in 1998, the French refused to condemn India. They refused to condemn India because they also wanted to test more nuclear weapons. And they were also in the process of testing nuclear weapons. That's the reason why they refused to condemn India. Now let's look at the France-Pakistan relationship. 1994, France wins a submarine contract to supply three submarines to the Pakistanis. Yes? The French ministry's Direction des Constructions Navales, three diesel-powered Agosta 90B type submarines. Let's see some more Pakistan submarine capabilities. So, 1990, they commissioned a Hashmat class submarine Chantier du Bijan. In 1992, one more from the same place, Khalid class in 93, and so on and so forth. History. Let's take a look at the Pakistani history. The first PNS Ghazi submarine of Pakistan was acquired from the US in 1964. Between 1969 and 1970, the Pakistanis acquired three Daphne-class submarines from France. They lost the PNS Ghazi to India in the 1971 war. India destroyed the submarine. We sank it. Good fun. So the Pakistanis acquired a second-hand Daphne-class vessel from Portugal, okay, in 75. In 1978, the Pakistanis acquired two Agosta-class submarines from the French. In 1994, three more French submarines from Naval Group SA. In the early 2000s, the Pakistani Navy considered an additional purchase from DCNS from the French, but they did not have the money, so they abandoned it. But the French were very much willing to sell more submarines to Pakistan. Yes. So the French have been selling lots of submarines to Pakistan. And this is an article by Humaira Dar, whoever she is. It's you can look it up. This is the link in case you want to pause the thing and see. France and Pakistan, story of an unwritten alliance. So France and Pakistan were essentially unstated allies. It was a de facto alliance that these two nations had. Okay, this was in the past. Now, this is an article from June 30, 2022. It's very recent. Pakistan and France, a positive U-turn. So this is in June 2022. We know that in April 22, Mr. Imran Khan, Captain Imran Khan, was removed from his position as Prime Minister of Pakistan. While he was the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Pakistan-France relationships, the relationship became rather bad. Yes. The relations between Pakistan and France drastically deteriorated since 2020 when Imran Khan accused Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, of attacking Islam by encouraging Islamophobia for defending the right to publish various cartoons in the context of the beheading of a French teacher and so on and so forth. Pakistan then objected to French legislation labeling it as anti-separatism bill and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of bad blood between Pakistan and France when Mr. Imran Khan was the Prime Minister of Pakistan. Now, he has been removed. Mr. Sharif has been put in place. He has been appointed as the new Prime Minister by whoever is ruling Pakistan and whoever is ruling the rulers, the real overlords. As we know, China is now no longer in control of Pakistan. The Americans are back in control. So all of this essentially is being orchestrated by the US. They are the puppet masters, right? Now let's see this. This article was from June 30, 2022. This article is from November 1, 2022, just a month ago. Pakistan-France bilateral ties on the mend. It is believed that France played an important role in ensuring Pakistan's exit from the FATF grey list. Indians were very upset that Pakistan has been removed from the FATF grey list and now any nation can trade with Pakistan and not worry about the terrorism support, which is anyway going on. If a nation invests, let's say like Japan, $1 billion in Pakistan, how do we know that a significant portion of the money is not going to be rerouted into supporting terrorism against India and Afghanistan? We don't know it. But now that Pakistan is no longer on the FATF grey list, nations can do trade with Pakistan and invest in Pakistan without worrying about this. Someone will accuse us of investing in terrorism. So who helped Pakistan get off the FATF grey list? It was France. Yes? Isn't that wonderful? It is a great achievement by France. They helped Pakistan get off the FATF grey list. Yes? And now, so that's about France. That's about Japan. Let's talk about Taiwan as well. Lots of Indians have a great amount of love for Taiwan. A lot of Indians believe that India and Taiwan have a convergence of strategic interests because we have a common enemy, China. Is that really true, my dear friends? Let's take a look at this map. Republic of China, which means Taiwan, administrative divisions and territorial disputes. All right. So the entire light blue thing, the teal region, is China. This bluish purple island is Taiwan. The Taiwanese claim the entirety of China. They also claim the entirety of Mongolia, the land of Genghis Khan. The Taiwanese have territorial claims on Mongolia. This yellow region on top, it is Russia. It's part of Russia. The Taiwanese also claim Russian territory. They also claim Japanese territory. But let's look further west, shall we, my friends? Yes, they claim parts of Afghanistan. They claim the certain part of Jammu and Kashmir that is currently under Pakistani occupation. They claim parts of Aksai Chin. They claim the whole of Aksai Chin, right? And over here, most of the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh is claimed by the Taiwanese, and they also claim parts of Myanmar. The Taiwanese have expansive territorial claims. They claim Arunachal Pradesh. They claim Aksai Chin. They claim Jammu and Kashmir. They said, that's the deal. That's the Taiwanese worldview. That is, so if the Taiwanese, let's say, hypothetically come to power and they're able to take over China, they will carry on the same policies or maybe even worse policies, maybe even more aggressive policies than what the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping are carrying out. India has no friends, my dear friends. Whether it's the US, we all know about. We've spoken about it. Whether it's the US, whether it is Japan, whether it is Russia, whether it's Israel, whether it's France, whether it's Taiwan, or whoever else. There are no friends. There are no friends in geopolitics. It doesn't matter. We don't need friends. Because international relations are not on the basis of friendship. Now, what are the things that international relations are based on? Like I said, it's based on self-interest, convergence of interest. There are temporary alliances and temporary enmities. It's all about economics and trade and defense and threat perceptions and national goals, national objectives, national boundaries, national interests, convergence of interests. And a lot of it is about trade. It's all about economics. Yes. So let's take a look at India's trade partners, because that is also very an interesting way of looking at things. Yes. So let's put some trading information, data on the screen to understand how this works. Trade. So I'm putting on the screen some data, some information from 2020. It's quite recent. It's not entirely up, last minute up to date, but it's reasonably recent, 2020. Yes. So this is India. India's exports are 6.26% packaged medicaments, diamonds, cyclic hydrocarbons, refined petroleum, rice, cars, crustaceans, frozen bovine meat, and lots of other stuff. That's what India exports. The total exports in 2020 were $284 billion because of the downturn in the economy due to the thing that happened. The thing that we don't speak about. The thing, the P word, the C word, whatever. And the destinations. India's largest trading partners. China, 6.52%. UAE, 6.36%. US, 17.5%. Hong Kong, 3.23%. Then you have Germany, 3.1%. UK, 2.73%. Where does Israel figure in all this? Vietnam is 1.62%. South Korea, 1.63%. Israel is 0.72%. Yes? So Israel is a very small trading partner of India. So this is from the Indian perspective. This is who India traded with in 2020. Today, the situation may be different, but this is reasonably recent, so we can take a look at this to understand how things are. Now, let's take a look at Israel. Israel's exports are about $50 billion in 2020. 27.7% US, China 9.12%, Palestine 6.57%. India is reasonably big on this horizon, 3.23%. So India is number four, I believe. No, then we have Netherlands, then we have Germany, then we have UK. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. India is number six and number seven from Israel's perspective. So India is reasonably important for the Israelis, and they would like this percentage of trade to grow larger. Why not? It's great. Yes. So that is Israel. Now let's take a look at Japan. Japan's exports were $623 billion, 21% China, 18% US, 6.88% South Korea, Chinese Taipei, so on and so forth. Where is India? Does India figure? India is 1.5%. So for Japan, India is not that important. Yes? For Israel also, India is reasonably important. For Japan, India is not so important. Let's look at China. $2.65 trillion of exports. Yes? US, 16.5%. Hong Kong, almost 10%, Japan, 5.7%, South Korea, 4.13%, Germany, UK, Netherlands, Russia. Does India figure anywhere in this? Let's take a look. Does India figure anywhere? India is 2.43%. So India is not very important for China. China has many much larger trading partners that they would like to prioritize over India. So this is how. This is a significant force in geopolitics, trade, you know. That's how nations decide which are the important nations with whom they need to cooperate, right? Let's take a look at Russia. Russia, $203 billion. Most of it was crude petroleum, refined petroleum, coal, petroleum gas, gold. It's all raw materials, essentially. And some of it is refined and all. So China, $103 billion. More than half of Russia's trade was with China. Then you have South Korea and Japan, the US, $24 billion, UK, $17 billion. I don't even see India here. So that would actually explain. Today, this entire chart would be very different. Today, it would be very, very different. So this explains why Russia had a certain attitude towards India until very recently. Yes, let's take a look at the US. 1.34 trillion, much less than China, almost half of China. Yeah. Destinations, 16% Canada, 14% Mexico, 9% China, 4% Japan, South Korea, Germany, UK, Netherlands, France, Belgium, so on and so forth. Does India figure anywhere in this? Do I see India somewhere? Do I see India? I'm not able to see India. Ah, India is there. Nearly 2%. So India has not seen. It took me some time to see if India actually exists on this thing. India does, yes. India, the exports to India are less than those to South Korea or Chinese Taipei, which are very tiny nations. So you see, this is the reality in 2020. Germany, once again, as you can see, does India figure? India is 0.91% of Germany's exports. Yeah. France, how much does France export to India? 1% of France's exports go to India. So why would they consider India to be very important? The UK, where is the UK? Does India figure anywhere in this? India is 1.25%. So this was in 2020. The situation in 2022, 2023 may be significantly different, but it tells you how much of a mountain India has to climb. Can you change the year? No, the latest year is 2020. So you cannot go back and see a more recent set of statistics. But I hope this helps you understand how international, what is the foundation of international relations. If you want to know which website it is, this is the link, oec.world/en/profile/country/GBR, and you can decide which country you want to see. All right. So this is one of the foundations of geopolitics. How important are you to another nation? It depends on, to a large extent, on how much they export from you and how much they import from you. If you figure high in the percentages of their exports or import, then you are important to them. If you are 1% of their exports, why would they care for you? Why would they care about you? So if India has to raise its standing in the world geopolitically, these are the things that matter. You have to become a major exporter and also a major importer. Yes? And if you have a major trade surplus with another nation, that benefits you. So India has to rise. India has to become a manufacturing superpower, a great manufacturing power. India has to become a major exporter of commodities, of goods, of finished products, not of raw materials. Yeah? And that's how you rise as a nation. So I hope that helps you understand. It's not about love. It's not about affection. It's not about friendship. So that's how it happens. That's how it's done. People to people relations are immaterial in geopolitics. Indians believe that we have great relations with the people of so-and-so nation. So our nations also have a good relationship, great relationship. That is not the case. It's, you know, the truth is that nations with very different cultures and even nations whose people dislike each other can become great geopolitical allies and great geopolitical partners if their national interests converge. Even if the people dislike each other, even if the cultures are very different, the nations can still become geopolitical allies. But remember that all alliances are temporary. So the principles of geopolitics are all these. Cooperation based on mutual interest, cooperation based on reciprocity. That's how we should, that's the kind of geopolitical relationships we should have. Mutual interest, reciprocity. I help you, you help me. I will not help you if you don't help me. Everything has a price. So based on these things, we should have strategic cooperation, tactical cooperation, and so on with various nations. But remember, my dear friends, India has no friends. And that's excellent. We are 1.3 billion people. Why do we need friends? We are enough to take on the whole world. We are enough to beat the whole world. We are enough. We have ourselves, and that is enough. So that, I hope, makes sense to you. Don't look for friendships and love outside your nation. Nobody's going to give you that. Be realistic. I am not asking anybody, I'm not asking Indians to hate or dislike any nation. Be realistic. That's all I'm saying. That's all. All right. Okay, now let's talk about something else. Let's talk about Pakistan, shall we? Because I said we will talk about Pakistan. So what's happened in Pakistan? Pakistan has a new army chief. Isn't that wonderful? They should be happy. So what does their new army chief look like? Let's take a look at him. His name is Asad Munir, I think. Asim Munir. He vows to defend motherland on Kashmir visit. So apparently he visited the Pakistan-occupied region, a portion of Jammu and Kashmir. India won't be able to achieve whatever and so on. That's a standard nonsense that the Pakistanis say. They have to say these things in order to be relevant, yes. So Pakistan has... The previous army chief was Mr. Bajwa. Not Mr. Bajwa. General Qamar Javed Bajwa. He was the previous army chief. Now they have appointed a new person, Asim Munir. He has been in several important positions in the past. He was a director general of the military intelligence, DGMI. And another important position he had was the director general of the inter-services intelligence, ISI. He was the DGISI. And another thing that puts him apart is that he is a Hafiz a Quran, a person who has memorized the Quran, right? So that's the kind of guy he is. He has served in prominent positions in the past. He apparently enjoys the backing of the outgoing army chief, Qamar Javed Bajwa. General Asim Munir was not the choice of Imran Khan. Imran Khan supported this person, Lieutenant General Faiz Hamid. So, Lieutenant General Faiz Hamid, unfortunately for him, has taken early retirement. Yes, because Mr. Asim Munir has been appointed. So, this gentleman, unfortunately, was made to retire. And he was in favor of Mr. Imran Khan. Imran Khan favored him. But Imran Khan is out, and therefore, a different person has been appointed. For what does it mean for India? It means nothing for India. It doesn't change anything for India. Pakistan, it doesn't matter who is ruling Pakistan, who is placed as the army chief. It doesn't make any difference to us at all. Whether it was Faiz Hamid or this person, Asim Munir, doesn't matter at all for us. Pakistan is Pakistan. They are India's enemy. Their only objective is to destroy India. And Pakistan is a terrorist nation. No matter who they appoint as the army chief, Pakistan is going to remain a terrorist nation, unfortunately, because of the policies of their leaders, right? That's what, in their eyes, gives them legitimacy. The fact that the fiction that India is their enemy. So that's the situation in Pakistan. How is the situation in Afghanistan? So we know that So I have not discussed Afghanistan in depth for a very long time. We've had a few episodes of Ask Abhijit about Afghanistan. That's more than a year ago, when the entire US withdrawal from Afghanistan happened, the complete disaster, and they handed over Afghanistan on a plate to the Taliban. At that time, I had said several things. I had said several things that people kind of laughed at. They said that now Afghanistan is a proper Pakistani puppet. The Pakistanis will enjoy complete control over Afghanistan. I said that's not going to happen. I said that the Taliban are anti-Pakistan. The Taliban are Pashtun nationalists, and they're going to have great amounts of friction with Pakistan. The two countries will essentially become enemies. The Taliban claim Pakistani territory and so on. And today the situation is exactly what I had said. I had said that India and the Taliban will find ways to cooperate together. And that's also what's happening. The Taliban government wants India to resume its activities, its development activities in Afghanistan. They want India to keep on investing in Afghanistan and keep building whatever infrastructure India was building for the Afghan people. The Taliban want that to resume. And yet, we have to understand the Taliban are not India's friends. But they don't see India as a major enemy. Their major enemy is Pakistan. And even if India, let's look at the map. Even if India were to regain the Pakistan-occupied portion of Jammu and Kashmir and Ladakh, and if India were to re-establish its historical territorial boundaries with Afghanistan, even then, I don't think India and Afghanistan will have an adversarial relationship, because the Afghans know, everyone knows, India doesn't have territorial ambitions, hegemonic expansionist ambitions. So I am sure the Taliban and the Afghans would prefer to have India on their border rather than Pakistan. Yeah. So the situation is like that. And we are witnessing lots of clashes along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. The Taliban and the Pakistan army enjoy routine clashes soldiers die on both sides. And the Pakistanis also, obviously, they believe that the Taliban are fomenting terrorism in Balochistan. We've had lots of terrorists. I mean, except what you would call the Balochistan, the people of Balochistan desire independence from the terrorist regime in Pakistan. Yes. And the Pakistanis accused the Taliban of helping the Balochistan freedom struggle against the foreign occupation of Pakistan. Even the Chinese have been targeted in Balochistan, right? So the situation, the relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan is not good. It is bad and it is deteriorating. The Afghans accuse the Pakistan Air Force of violating Afghan airspace and bombarding civilians and all that, yes? Even the Americans seem to have used Pakistani territory to launch certain drone strikes on Afghanistan, which is vitiating the atmosphere. So from the U.S. perspective, the U.S. has left Afghanistan. The U.S. does no longer have a presence in Central Asia at all. They have left this big power vacuum. So by default, the Chinese were made to step in and fill the power vacuum. So everyone was predicting that the Chinese will now take over Afghanistan in a variety of ways. That's not happened. The Chinese are not enjoying this situation. They see Afghanistan is a problem area, is a problematic country. They are wary of the Taliban. They are also wary of the newfound U.S. stranglehold over Pakistan. The Pakistanis are no longer a Chinese vassal. They are now a U.S. vassal. And the Chinese are worried that through Pakistan and through Afghanistan, there will be an influx of fighters into the Xinjiang region, the East Turkestan region that the Chinese occupy, and there will be more terrorist activities in Chinese-occupied territory. The Chinese wanted, when the previous regime was in power, Ashraf Ghani regime was in power, they wanted to use Afghanistan, Afghan soil, as a conduit for their Belt and Road initiative. After the Taliban took over, the Chinese have done nothing. They have taken no steps to make this a reality. The BRI is kind of dormant right now. There is no activity happening, no infrastructure being constructed. In Afghanistan, China has essentially no government presence. Whatever Chinese presence exists in Afghanistan is through individual entrepreneurs who are trying their luck, the way the Chinese were entrepreneurs have tried their luck in various parts of Africa. The Chinese entrepreneurs have a very high tolerance for risk. So those who have a very high tolerance for risk have made their way into Afghanistan. They have tried to invest in various businesses, but it looks like it's not working out very well. And the Chinese government is staying away from Afghanistan. So whatever Chinese presence exists in Afghanistan is small-scale presence, and it is done on individual basis, not on government-to-government basis. So the Afghans are not enjoying any Chinese investment or any Chinese presence, which actually is good for India. So that is the situation in Afghanistan. The Afghans, the Taliban wants India to step up its presence in Afghanistan. They want more Indian investment in Afghanistan. They want India to restart the infrastructure building activities that India was doing before the Taliban took over, before the Americans withdrew from Afghanistan. So, and yet, as we know, the Taliban, when they put out a map of the region, they show the wrong boundaries of India. So we have to remember that even though relations are reasonably okay, the Taliban are not India's friends. Remember that. But they are bigger enemies of Pakistan. So we can use that to our advantage and achieve our geopolitical, geostrategic objectives, because that's how it is done. So that, in brief, is the situation in Afghanistan, very briefly. Now let's talk about the other big news, which is China and Saudi Arabia. So where are we? Let's put that on the screen. Mr. Xi Jinping, who rarely travels outside his country, has gone to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. He recently went to Bali, right, for the G20 summit. And before that, I believe he had gone for the SCO summit in Central Asia. So he makes very rare trips outside his country. And right now, his country is in the midst of turmoil. The zero COVID policy, all the protests. I don't know what's happening. Maybe they've been crushed or whatever. But the situation is not very good in China. The economy has taken a big downturn and all kinds of social issues. social unrest. And yet, despite all those challenges, Mr. Xi Jinping has gone to Saudi Arabia. And this is a report from yesterday. China and Saudi Arabia pledged to widen ties on all fields and work together on Iran nuclear program. Yes. So there's a joint declaration. They pledged to upgrade relations. The two sides look to go beyond energy cooperation into areas like technology, infrastructure, and security. Yes. That's what's happening. So that is a deal. But we have to look at this in the bigger context. What happened? Why is Saudi Arabia making these overtures towards China? Why is Saudi Arabia saying that it wants to join BRICS? Saudi Arabia has for the longest time been a Western asset, a Western vassal. First, the UK, and after the UK became a third-rate world power, they have been a vassal of the US. And the Saudis have contributed to the creation of the petrodollar, as we know. Yes? So what's happening? So we have to understand that the Americans have treated Mr. MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, very harshly. President Joe Biden, when he was campaigning to become the president of the US, had promised to turn Saudi Arabia and Mohammed bin Salman into a pariah. Yes? And even when Mr. Trump was the president, Mohammed bin Salman was treated very badly. For instance, let's take a look at this. Here's a piece of news. This is from 2018. Mohammed bin Salman, lonely and ignored at G20 summit. Unwanted and isolated. He's failed the G20 summit as Jamal Khashoggi's shadow loomed over world leaders' reunion and so on. After G20 photo, Saudi prince left stage quickly, did not greet leaders because he was treated as an outsider, as a pariah. Nobody wanted to speak to him. As you can see, he's over here on the side. He's sidelined. Yes. So that's the deal. So the Americans have been treating him very harshly. He's very upset with them. On the other hand, Mr. Modi has treated, India and the Saudis have excellent relations, all thanks to Mr. Modi, who has made it a point to build an excellent relationship, not only with Saudi Arabia, but with all the other Gulf nations, more or less. So Mr. Xi Jinping has gone to Saudi Arabia. He has met with the Saudi leaders. He has also been part of an Arab-China summit. Yes, I think there were more than 30 deals that were finalized. Investments in, obviously, it's all about oil majorly, but also investments in other things like green energy and solar panels and information technology, IT, cloud services, and construction and transportation, and so on and so forth. And also a $30 billion deal about oil. Yes. The other thing that's important is that Egypt has joined. This is a news. It's some time ago, but see, Egypt is also making moves to join BRICS. This is about a year ago that Egypt became a member of the new development bank of BRICS. Yes. So many nations, as we know, like Turkey, like Saudi Arabia, like Egypt and Uruguay, and Argentina and many other nations want to join BRICS. I think there are more than 13, 14 nations that want to join BRICS. BRICS is becoming a big deal. Many nations have already joined the BRICS Development Bank before becoming members of BRICS. So the Chinese are now taking this forward. The overall long-term aim is to create a BRICS currency, which is a BRICS reserve currency, which will be a competitor to the US dollar. So the US dollar is built on debt. It's just debt. It's built on debt. The BRICS reserve currency, whenever it is created, will be built on various commodities, a basket of commodities. One of them will be oil, obviously, but you will also have things like uranium and gold and coal and graphite and copper and various metals and things like that. So the BRICS reserve currency will be built on actual commodities. It will have actual value. The US dollar is just promises. It's paper money built on promises, debt. Yes? I don't know what the BRICS currency will be called, the BRICS buck. Yeah. And BRICS will create a joint payment network, and many nations want to be part of it. Yes. Bangladesh, I believe, also wants to be part of BRICS. Maybe Uruguay, maybe the UAE, and so on. Yeah. So now what the Chinese are doing is that they are balancing their activities in the Middle East. See, I have said that the BRI, Belt and Road Initiative of China, is kind of stagnant right now. It's kind of dead in the water as a consequence of the coronavirus pandemic and everything that happened after that. The Chinese will not just sit and let this happen. They will try to restart it. restart this. Right now, their superpower ambitions have taken a huge, huge blow, a huge setback. Their economy is not growing. It's going negative now. Yeah, the population is aging and all that. But they will still try their best to revive the BRI. And all of this, what they're doing right now with Saudi Arabia, etc., in the Middle East, with Iran, is all steps in that direction. BRICS, see, any multilateral organization is led by the most powerful nation. It is often hijacked by the most powerful nation. See what happens with the UN, right, for instance. See, look at the situation in NATO, in the EU. The most powerful nation is the US. And that's why NATO is a US proxy. The EU is a US proxy. These nations don't have any independent foreign policy. So similarly, China would want, they would like to turn BRICS into their own instrument that advances their national interests. That will happen unless India and Russia get together and counterbalance China. So we are seeing all this multi-pronged tussle, this tug of war happening right now. The Chinese are taking the initiative. Yes, right now in the Gulf region. In the past, in case you don't know, they also had in 2021, I believe, last year, Iran and China came up with this 25-year cooperation program in which the Chinese will invest $400 billion into the Iranian economy in exchange for a steady supply of heavily discounted oil. And this is an article by an American organization, The National Interest, how the China-Iran deal could reshape the Middle East. It's a $400 billion deal. And its strategic significance will determine the future of the Middle East. Now, we have to understand that even today, the Saudis and the Iranians are rivals. They are enemies. And both, even the Iranians want to join BRICS. So is it possible to make these enemies come together and cooperate? These are very strange bedfellows. But the Chinese are trying to find a way of getting Saudi Arabia and Iran to look past the historical enmity and all that and cooperate in a variety of ways, in a way that is mutually beneficial for all. The Chinese and maybe BRICS will help Iran with their nuclear deal. So the Americans had a nuclear deal with Iran, which President Trump walked out of unilaterally, yes. And then they placed all these sanctions on Iran. BRICS could step in and help alleviate some of those sanctions, yes. There are lots of nations in the Gulf region that have been hit very hard by U.S. actions and U.S. sanctions. Syria is one. Yes, Iraq has been devastated by the Americans. They have a regime that has been placed by the Americans in power and so on. So we are seeing this global tussle happening right now. The Chinese are leading this thing. They will do it for their own self-interest, but they will want to give some of it to the BRICS nations also, so that the BRICS nations can also get on board this thing and support what they're doing. So it's a very complex scenario that we are living through right now. The Chinese are leading this, and it looks like the eventual goal will be to de-dollarize the world. De-dollarization means create a currency that will be a viable and credible alternative as a reserve currency to the US dollar. If that happens, it's going to be a huge, huge setback to the US and their global hegemony. And the Americans obviously will do their best to prevent these things from happening. They could even, I would say, possibly try to engineer a regime change in a nation like Saudi Arabia, possibly. So Mohammed bin Salman should be, well, I'm sure he understands this, and he would need to be really, really careful, and he will have to anticipate what the Americans could do. Because this, essentially, from the American perspective, is a rebellion against them. Yeah. So that's the situation, and we will keep an eye on this. So that's the situation in Saudi Arabia, the Chinese overtures to Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis are reciprocating. And they want to become part of BRICS. And they want to free themselves from the clutches of the great hegemon, the overlord, the emperor, the US. Yes? Let's talk about Mr. Zelensky. Mr. Zelensky is Time's Person of the Year. Isn't that fantastic? Mr. Zelensky. Let's put that on the screen. So Time magazine in the past has... Oops, sorry. Let us stop that. Yep. One second. This one here. So, Time magazine has appointed or declared Mr. Zelensky as the person of the year, 2022. And Time magazine has a wonderful history of choosing very appropriate people as person of the year. I'm sure Mr. Stalin at some point in time was chosen as the person of the year. I'm sure Adolf Hitler was person of the year when he was alive at some point in time. And so, you know, they have a history, they have a record, a track record of choosing very dodgy people as the person of the year. So this is all obviously propaganda. They are trying to fool the world and make people believe that Zelensky is some great freedom fighter and a force for good in the world. Yes. So this is part of that. This is propaganda. He, of course, as we know, is an actor. He is a puppet. He has no real power. He does whatever he is told. And most of his time he is spent in green screens, with green screens behind him, as we know. Yeah. And Time magazine has published this wonderful article, Volodymyr Zelensky in the spirit of Ukraine. He's a great freedom fighter along the lines of Che Guevara and God knows who else. And this famous US actor, Sean Penn, he has gifted one of his Oscars to Ukraine. It was a lucky charm in the war. Sean Penn is a great actor. Yeah, I'm sure we all know him. I think he has won multiple Oscars, if I'm not mistaken. And obviously he is on certain substances that enhance performance, whatever. So he has gifted his Oscar, one of his Oscars, to Mr. Zelensky, from one actor to another fellow actor. So yeah, it's nice to know, but understand that. So we have to understand that these Western accolades, these Western honors, these Western awards all further the Western interest. If an Indian person is awarded a Western award, you have to understand they are doing it to further their own interest. Whether it's a Nobel Prize, whether it's something else, I'm sure Zelensky could in the future, if he survives, if he is kept for another year or so as the president of Ukraine, he could even possibly win the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize or whatever. So we have to understand that this is not to be taken very seriously. These awards, these achievements mean nothing. These accolades mean nothing. There is a certain award called the Magsaysay Award. I understand that multiple Indians have been given this award. This is an award that is given in recognition of services to the United States cause. Please understand that. So please do not take these awards and accolades seriously. They mean nothing. They are meant, they serve to further the national interest and the objectives of the West. Now, let's conclude by touching upon the Ukraine scenario. Like I said, right now, Ukraine and the entire of most of Russia is in the midst of what they call the Rasputitsa season, the mud season. In the last episode, I showed you a video. Of tanks, how they get bogged down in the mud in the November-December time period, and also in the spring season when the ice thaws. So winter will be in full force in Ukraine by the end of December. And I said that most likely the Russians are waiting for that to happen, for General Winter to make his appearance in the conflict. And maybe then there will be a major Russian offensive, a winter offensive, right? So right now, let's take a look at briefly at what's happening in Ukraine. What does the news tell us? So obviously certain things are going on, you know, words and actions and things. So Putin says Russia may add nuclear first strike to strategy. The Russian leader cites what he calls US preventive strike idea. Putin warned this week of risk of nuclear conflict was rising. Yes. So this is from AP News. This is from yesterday. Same thing. Russia could adopt the US preemptive strike concept. The US concept of using preemptive military strikes, including nuclear strikes, so that's what he said when he went to Kyrgyzstan in a Moscow-dominated summit of ex-Soviet nations and all that. So you can see the tensions are rising. There is now talk from the Russians of a preemptive strike possible. So they are open to ditch the no first use concept, and they may be open to using a preemptive nuclear strike. Putin says any country that dares to launch a nuclear attack on Russia will be wiped out from the face of the earth. He said that Russia's advanced hypersonic weapons would give a befitting reply to any country that dared to attack Russia with nuclear weapons. So this is all words. This is all a rising of tensions. But yes, you can see that various escalation. There's a whole escalation ladder that is played out before an actual nuclear exchange happens. So we are going in that direction. I hope a nuclear war doesn't happen. I hope this conflict does not turn nuclear, but slowly, gradually, we are inching in that direction. That's what it would look like from all the statements that are being made on both the sides, from the NATO side and from the Russian side. Another piece of news is that Russia's best warplanes, the Su-35 Flanker, the Sukhoi 35 Flanker ES, is heading to Iran. US says the deal has been made in exchange for drones and missiles. So the Iranians are selling the Shahed drones to the Russians, the loitering munitions, the suicide drones, and various missiles. And in exchange, the Russians apparently will send Iran Sukhoi 35 fighter planes. That will be a great, great deal for the Iranians. So great for Iran. So apparently, Iranian pilots received Su-35 training in Russia in the spring season, indicating Iran may start acquiring the aircraft within the following year. Yes, this was disclosed by the Americans. So this is American news. I'm not sure if the Russians have said this. So the US also says that Iran is now Russia's top military backer with these suicide drones, loitering munitions and all that. So that's what's happening. That's part of what's happening right now. We are possibly witnessing what you could perhaps call the calm before the storm. The calm in the Rasputitsa season before the ground freezes, and then maybe you could have a major escalation of the conflict, maybe a major Russian winter offensive. In the meanwhile, all these little stories are playing out. Right now on the Ukraine border, in Ukraine, on the war front, we are not seeing any major advances, military advances on either side. The Russians are not making any major military advance into Ukraine. The Ukrainians are not making any major advance into what they call Russian-occupied territory. There is major fighting happening in one place, in some places, including the Bakhmut meat grinder. But the fighting is all holding fighting, more or less in the same position, no major advances. So we could possibly be currently witnessing the calm before a major winter storm. Let's see if that happens. The Americans are making noises to the same effect. And that maybe the Russians are waiting for the ground to freeze before making a major move. So that's what possibly could happen. That's what I've spoken about in the past. And we are still within the Rasputitsa season. So right now, nothing is happening. Once the ground freezes, things could change. Maybe 2 weeks from now, maybe by the end of December, or whenever the Russians choose. Obviously, once the ground freezes, there will be a limited window of time, 2-3 months, in which they can make their moves. So maybe sooner rather than later. Yeah. So let's see how it goes. That's what it looks like to me from the perspective of logic. Yeah, from the logic of strategy, that's what would make sense. But of course, we don't know what's going on in Mr. Putin's mind. What plans they have, we don't know. But that's what looks like the most likely course of action. So we will keep an eye on this and we'll keep discussing these matters. So yeah, that brings me to the end of today's episode. I think this may have been the longest episode of the Indian Interest thus far. So that's it. That's the end of today's episode. Thank you so much once again, all of you, for viewing, for your viewership, for watching this even while a World Cup quarterfinal match is happening. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And we'll keep on doing this. So I will see you in less than 24 hours time in the live stream, in tomorrow's live stream of the Ask Abhijit Show. Until then, take care. Thank you very much. I'll see you very soon. Bye.